The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hey, good afternoon, and welcome to the Thursday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. Today on the program, we're going to give those of you who listen in the first hour an opportunity to hear about the Restored Hope Network Conference, Hope 2.0, Friday and Saturday. That's this Friday and Saturday. Ann Paulk will explain all of that when she joins us later this hour. So I hope you can stick around for that. First, taking a look at some of the news. And by the way, we'll be talking about what's happening in Seattle, which is extraordinary. Now, that's the word I'm choosing to use at this point. We'll clarify a bit later. Anyway, President Trump tweeted late Wednesday that the domestic terrorists have taken part of Seattle amid protests over George Floyd's death and blamed the city's radical left Democrats for contributing to the unrest. Radical left governor at Jay Inslee and the mayor of Seattle are being taunted and played at a level that our great country has never seen before, the president tweeted. Take back our city now. If you don't do it, I will. This is not a game. These ugly anarchists must be stopped. Actually, he spelled it stooped, which, of course, anyway, immediately move fast, he went on to say. Well, domestic terrorists have taken over Seattle, run by radical left Democrats, of course. Law and order, the president added. In a follow-up tweet, well, Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin, a Democrat, took a swipe back at Trump, tweeting, "Make us all safe. Go back to your bunker. Black Lives Matter." Well, Attorney General William Barr told Fox News that on the 29th of May, the unrest was tense near the White House, and the Secret Service recommended the president go down to the bunker. We can't have that in our country. Well, on Tuesday night, hundreds of protesters stormed Seattle City Hall demanding Durkin's resignation just days after seizing a six-block downtown zone that includes a shuttered police precinct. Demonstrators remained peaceful without reports of violence or injuries, but activists are pushing Durkin to step down as she refuses to defund the city's police department. Other related developments, the Democratic representative for President Biden, is attending a high roller fundraiser today, headlined by the Defund the Police activist John Legend, even though Biden says he doesn't support that effort. The Department of Justice is revealing striking details of riot arrests, including helicopter laser strikes and precinct arson. New York City detectives unions are turning the tables, vowing to sue Floyd rioters who attack officers. And Representative Matt Gaetz says Antifa has designated Seattle, their capital of new worktopia, or rather woketopia. Well, confirmed cases of the coronavirus passed 2 million in the U.S. on Wednesday, with infection rates in many areas appearing to spike, despite declines in infections throughout Europe, according to a report. The U.S. has seen a 36.5% increase in daily cases in recent days amid street protests and states' reversals of shutdown policies, a striking difference compared to the top 10 other countries with the most COVID-19 infections to date, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, obtained by Yahoo. Worst times are ahead, says Joe Jared, who is a public health researcher at the University of Arizona, who is helping to provide projections to the state's health departments, according to the Washington Post. The preponderance of evidence indicates community transmission is increasing. Other related developments, U.S. coronavirus deaths could double. They now hit 200,000 by September. Tucker Carlson bashed the lockdown proponents, saying they used a public health emergency to subvert democracy. And Alex Berenson says that Europe's data indicates ending lockdowns do not seem to make much difference to COVID-19 spread. Well, the crowd of protesters smashed, cut up, doused in paint, burned, and sprayed graffiti over a Confederate monument outside a courthouse in Portsmouth, Virginia on Wednesday night. Part of it tumbled down, reportedly seriously injuring one of the demonstrators. Confederate statues and other monuments linked to controversial figures have drawn the ire of demonstrators protesting the death of George Floyd as the protesters consider them to be symbols of racism. Part of the problem is they don't distinguish between those that may be interpreted thusly and those that are monuments to the service of Civil War Black soldiers, the 54th, I'm thinking of, and if time permits, we'll get into that later in the program. It's a symbol that represents an ideology of white supremacy, Mark Whitaker, a former local lawmaker, told Virginia Pilot in Norfolk. It really speaks to the consciousness of a city and of people. They would allow such an image of hate to continue to stand all these years. Now, this is from Mark Whitaker, a former local lawmaker who apparently allowed it to stand for years and said nothing. Well, coronavirus work from home has made most Americans want some form of remote employment. That's not altogether surprising, even though several states have begun phased reopening plans to keep the economy moving despite the coronavirus pandemic. Some American employees would like to continue working from home full time despite the cost. A new creditcards.com survey found, in fact, more than one third of respondents who were given the opportunity to work from home said they don't want to return to their workplace when state and federal restrictions lift. This is the sentiment from workers in late May when the survey was taken. They also found that working from home cost employees money. But 35% say they want to continue. Although working from home may have its perks, according to some respondents, the task has hiked up regular monthly expenses by $108 an average employee, according to creditcards.com. My expense has exceeded that, just saying that. Well, let's see. Wall Street Journal says the real issue is with police unions, from the article. An editorial board piece, police have a point that complaints against them are often dubious and they need an advocate to defend them. But collective bargaining agreements go beyond due process and insulate officers from accountability for egregious and serial misconduct. We talked about that earlier in the week as well. Meanwhile, J.K. Rowling doesn't toe the line on trans women, and that is an unforgivable sin on the left. When you read J.K. Rowling's thoughtful explanation of where she is and how the nightmare of thought police began, the Washington Post editorial proves even more shallow. Well, A&E is dropping the police show Life PD. The New York Times is going after the children's show Paw Patrol for portraying police in a positive light. Apparently, we're supposed to view all police as corrupt rather than those who are actually corrupt. It's the very same crime that we're decrying in this movement, Black Lives Matter, that you don't see all members of a particular group in a particular way. However, apparently that's allowed when it comes to police officers. I've since learned that Paw Patrol is not being considered for removal, which is good news. David Harsanyi points out that once we start dictating what is and isn't permissible to see, there will be no bottom. The list of potentially problematic books, art, and movies is massive. And the latest target, Splash Mountain, it's apparently racist. They worry because it's based upon the movie Song of the South. And rioters in Virginia have beheaded and torn down statues, as is the case all across the country. And Florida has closed in on taking part of the Republican convention from North Carolina. The story quotes Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel from her interview with Hugh Hewitt. And a UCLA professor was suspended for not canceling exams for Black students. Apparently, they suggest that they should not be required to take these exams because they're African American and they've been triggered. Now, the loss of education and accountability apparently has taken second fiddle. From the story, Klein writes, whom students slammed as racist and dismissive was also placed under police protection at his Malibu home after receiving threats from critics furious over the email exchange, the Free Beacon reported. Well, this day in history, 2001, Timothy McVeigh is executed by ejection at the federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana, for the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing that killed 168 people. 1776, the Continental Congress forms a committee to draft a Declaration of Independence calling for freedom from Britain. 1962, three prisoners at Alcatraz in San Francisco Bay stage an escape, leaving the island on a makeshift raft. They would never be found or heard from again, at least not by officials. 1982, E.T. the Extraterrestrial is released. It would become one of the most beloved films of all time. 1985, Karen Ann Quinlan, the comatose patient whose case prompted an historic right to die court decision, dies in Morris Plains, New Jersey at age 31. 1987, Margaret Thatcher becomes the first British Prime Minister in 160 years to win a third consecutive term of office as her Conservatives hold on to a reduced majority in Parliament. And finally, in 2009, on this day in history, with swine flu reported in more than 70 nations, the World Health Organization declares the first global flu pandemic in 41 years. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We'll continue to take a look at the top stories of the day when we return.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Later in the program, you'll hear from Ann Polk. In fact, in our next two segments, Restored Hope Network, Hope 2.0, their conference is going to be held this Friday and Saturday online this year rather than in Seattle as was originally planned. And we'll give you all the important details. And no, it's not too late to join the conference. Well, the U.S. economy is officially in recession. The National Bureau of Economic Research said Monday that the COVID-19 crisis has officially launched the U.S. economy into a recession, thus ending the longest economic expansion on record. The Business Cycle Dating Committee calls recessions based on broad checks on unemployment, rather, and production activity. The committee said that it had determined that economic activity had peaked in February, citing sharp drops in employment and personal consumption following that month. The recession declaration ended the 128-month economic expansion that began in June of 2009, which eclipsed the 1990s recovery as the longest on record. Well, the healthcare sector is in recession as well. Hospitals, physician and dental practices, clinical laboratories are hemorrhaging money and furloughing staff. Some are on the brink of bankruptcy. As hospitals struggle to remain solvent, furloughs and layoffs have become commonplace. And while the world is calling health workers heroes, many are losing their jobs. In April, the sector shed 1.4 million jobs, a 9% reduction in the healthcare workforce in the midst of a healthcare emergency. Hospitals aren't alone in laying off medical personnel. No sector of the medical industry has been untouched. Clinical laboratories, essential for processing tests for COVID-19, for example, and nursing homes, where 40 to 50% of COVID-19 deaths have occurred, also have seen reductions. A ban on non-emergent care, public fear of accessing medical care, and concerns with the supply chain have all contributed to the health and financial crisis. Hospital executives spent precious healthcare dollars preparing for a surge of patients from COVID-19 that, thankfully, never materialized in most places. But the cost of preparing for the pandemic and the loss of revenue from services has created an extraordinary challenge. An infusion of new money into hospitals to stave off losses has not been well targeted because those age 65 and older account for over 80% of COVID-19 deaths and are six times as likely than adults under 50 to be hospitalized with the infection. It made sense for Congress to increase Medicare rates and pay hospitals a 20% bonus for COVID-19 emissions, but long-term result, recession, has hit America's healthcare industry, and it's brutal. Well, the Seattle government this week essentially ceded a six-block area in its city to protesters declaring a cop-free autonomous zone, a dramatic loss of control by a government and police force, and another sign of the leftward lurch in a city that has a history of being one of the biggest bastions of radical progressive activism in the country. Tyler Olson points out that to protesters demanding that Mayor Jenny Durkan step down if she refuses to defund the city's police department are camped out in a self-declared Capital City Autonomous Zone, or CHAZ. The region spans six blocks and encompasses the Seattle Police Department East Precinct, which was effectively abandoned and boarded up on Monday. The Seattle Times reported Wednesday that on the shuttered precinct, a sign now reads, "This space is now property of the Seattle people." Of course, it always was. The takeover comes in the wake of nationwide unrest after the death of George Floyd. President Trump decried the Seattle government's apparent lack of desire to keep control of the area and threatened in a tweet on Wednesday to step in with federal forces. When the governor was asked, Governor Inslee, about the whole thing, he said, "Well, I don't know anything about it." The mayor has been silent, or had been up until perhaps earlier today. Well, after a weekend that included some violent clashes with police, demonstrators in the autonomous zone have largely remained peaceful without reports of violence or injuries, though the Seattle police are reporting there are armed guards in the area and that businesses in the zone are being extorted by protesters. The takeover of a large section of downtown Seattle is just one of many instances of far-left sentiment among the city's people and leaders in recent years. Some of the proclivities, Seattle labels itself a welcoming city, a term that referenced its sanctuary city status. In practice, that means that Seattle tells its police officers to refrain from requiring the immigration status of any person with limited exceptions and does not enforce civil federal immigration violations such as lack of immigration status. And city members this week vowed to cut policing funding by 50% in reaction to the violent clashes between police and protesters over the weekend, according to Q13 Fox. Multiple Seattle City Council members promised they would slash the police department's funding by half. Says Teresa Mosquedo, speaking to Q13 Fox, "I am committed to defunding the police, to using most of that money, 50% ideally, to invest back into communities that we failed." Durkin has said that she wouldn't back such a significant cut in police departments. Durkin, of course, is the mayor they are trying to let go in that area. Well, Seattle police say that they have received reports of armed guards and potential extortion in this self-declared autonomous zone that spans several blocks and includes a now closed precinct. We've heard anecdotally reports of citizens and businesses being asked to pay a fee to operate within the area. This is the crime of extortion. If anyone has been subjected to this, we need them to call 911, says the assistant chief of police. Protesters calling to defund the police and make sweeping reforms to law enforcement tactics have declared a six-block region spanning 13th Avenue past 11th Avenue near Cal Anderson Park and from East Olive Street to East Pike Street, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. The region encompasses the East Precinct, which was abandoned. Officers retreated from the area in an effort to quell the violence, which included multiple shootings, one that was sparked after a man rammed his vehicle into a crowd of protesters. Police officers have deployed tear gas and pepper spray to disperse large crowds of people. We wanted to be able to facilitate and support peaceful demonstrations. Demonstrations within the autonomous zone have been mostly peaceful. There's no one to demonstrate against, with no reports of violence. Speaking on the condition of anonymity, because they are not authorized to discuss the unfolding situation, one official told Fox News some people living in the area, which includes numerous bars, restaurants, businesses, and private residents, have been begging for help because they're not being allowed into their homes without ID. Now, they're being checked by this rabble that's established this autonomous zone, requiring residents who own their own property to provide ID before being allowed to enter their own residence or business. Police have been told to stay away from the region unless there is a 911 call. The officials also add that leaders in the anti-cop zone are starting to extort money, as I mentioned. One who lives in the autonomous zone says that the experience has been a bit stressful. It's like a scene from an apocalyptic movie that the city has just given over this part of the city to a group of people for whatever length of time, for whatever reason. The president calling for leadership to be restored. Police officers forbidden to enter into the area. The city council promising 50% of their police budget to go for other things, while the mayor has simply abdicated responsibility, and apparently the governor as well. Everyone's eyes are poised on Seattle, hoping that other areas will not attempt to do the same thing. Well, by the way, last summer, the Seattle City Council backed a petition that called for a drastic Green New Deal proposal. It lost a court battle over unconstitutional trash inspections in Seattle. A socialist councilwoman had been warring with Amazon for years there, and that created quite a stir. It unanimously voted to give money to illegal immigrants during the coronavirus pandemic, and the minimum wage is even higher than $15 per hour in Seattle. Just some examples of the city council in 2019 endorsing a radical Green New Deal proposal. So it shouldn't be altogether surprising that they would simply allow an autonomous zone to be wrested from the people of the city of Seattle, intimidating homeowners and businesses for a season. For what purpose remains to be seen, but attempting to force the hand of lawmakers there, the city council and the mayor, whom they've already called to be ousted from that position. So there you have the city of Seattle. Meanwhile, in the wake of the protests and riots that erupted following the killing of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police officer, a revealing transformation has been occurring in the country's media landscape. This is now the message coming from the media. The narrative about how society should look at this incident shall remain in accordance with the most radical woke voices. Deviating opinions will not be tolerated, words or violence. Well, that attitude was in full display in a dust-up at America's leading liberal newspaper. Chaos at the New York Times began after it published an editorial by Senator Tom Cotton, who argued that cities with police forces overwhelmed by looting and violence have the option under the Federal Insurrection Act to request aid from the military. Well, the article's headline was Call in the Troops, which had been selected by the New York Times editors. In it, Cotton explained how military force has been used to quell domestic unrest in the past, including those who attempted to obstruct desegregation at Little Rock's Central High School in Arkansas in 1957. Well, following the article's publication on the 3rd of June, the New York Times reporters and editors protested publicly en masse. Many claim that Cotton's opinions put their colleagues in danger, literally. Well, we'll talk more about that later in the program. But coming up, we're going to hear from Ann Paulk. Restored Hope Network Hope 2.0 conference is this Friday and Saturday. I'm looking forward to participating in it in part. This is a conference that is held annually. In fact, this year was going to be in Seattle. Well, thankfully, that's not the case, given what's happening there today. But the conference will be held online, and it's not too late to register. I would encourage you to do just that. We'll provide all the important details when I talk with Ann Paulk. She'll join us here in just a few moments. And hope you'll join us in the second hour of the program. We're going to talk about social justice warriors taking over the newsroom. We'll talk about the bitter irony of revolutions. And we'll talk about Black lives, businesses, neighborhoods, and monuments all matter. And when those that reflect the value of African Americans historically in our communities, we'll find out why protesters indiscriminately or perhaps foolishly are removing those monuments as well. All of that when we return. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Ann Paulk up next.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, good afternoon and welcome back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. As we've been saying, this has been a very unusual season. First of all, the pandemic meant that most of us spent our days, well, at home, working from home or not working at all. Then the protests and the event that inspired those protests has taken much of our attention and focus to some fundamental flaws in our nation's makeup. Well, in the midst of all of that, there have been events that have come and gone that we may have missed altogether. I want to make sure there's one event that you don't miss that's coming up this weekend, and that is the Restored Hope Network annual conference. Now, I was planning on making my way to Seattle and attending the conference, and I think I've mentioned here before that this is, of all the conferences that I'm either attending or participating in, this is the one I look forward to the most. Their annual conference, of course, had to be scrapped, but as is the case for many events, it now is available online, or will be this weekend, Hope 2.0. Well, I wanted to invite Ann Paulk, who's the executive director of Restored Hope Network, to talk with us about the conference and how you can participate. In fact, I'm hoping that because the conference is now going to be available online, that more of you who might not have been available to make that trip this year to Seattle might participate in all or in part in this remarkable conference. And welcome. It's so good to talk to you.
Oh, it's such a delight to talk with you, Georgine. I miss you, my friend.
I miss you as well. Now, some of our listeners may not know that you relocated from Portland, where I had easy access to you, and you and I could have lunch and long conversations, to Colorado. So we're not in close physical proximity, and the conference is one of those rare opportunities now that we would have had to get together. But I'm grateful for the technology that makes it possible for us to connect, at least in this way.
Yes, me too. I am thrilled about that. You're right. Well, I'm in Colorado Springs, Colorado. So it's quite a bit, about half the country away from you now.
Yeah. Now, Restored Hope Network's conference, Hope 2.0, was going to be held this year in Seattle, and it crosses the country from year to year. So I was looking forward to having it so close to home, But of course, events mean that this is now going to be an online event. Describe for us Hope 2.0 that's coming up this weekend.
Well, it is a conference for family members, for individuals who are grappling with their gender identity or their sexual orientation feelings of LGBT topics, and pastors and counselors and everybody. It is an event where we actually educate, equip, and care for those who are grappling with some pretty intense topics in their lives. So the goal is to cover topics from a biblical perspective. We're unashamedly a Christian organization who helps people align with their faith. And that's our goal, and that so many people are out there hurting. They have a loved one who came out as gay to them recently, or someone who's now saying they think they were born in the wrong body. And the world is saying, embrace it, embrace it, embrace it. Affirm this, because otherwise you're killing your loved one. And that's not true. In fact, some people go through incredible dissonance about who they are, and they begin disintegrating as they embrace this stuff. I mean, they're going about altering their physical body, whereas their DNA says male or female. And they're going through a bunch of degree of self-hatred and embracing that self-hatred to get to the other side of thinking themselves the opposite gender. And so my heart really goes out to the families who are grappling with this. My heart goes out to the individuals who are grappling with these things. And I just want to provide a leg up into wholeness and well-being that the gospel actually has to share. And so our messages, our content is surrounding these topics. Sean McDowell is going to share on the worldview behind transgenderism. Joe Dallas is going to share about ministering to family members. His topics are specifically for parents and family members who have a loved one who's becoming LGBT identified. And Linda Seiler, who just got her doctorate, considered herself a male inside a female's body. She thought of herself as a boy and was going to transition to that. But God got a hold of her and transformed her to align with her biological sex and embrace herself as God intended. And so she's going to share quite a bit about the theology of transformation and the science behind transformation. There's a lot of information that's not getting out into the cultural voice, into the secular media in particular. And so we want to give a breath of fresh air to those who are seeking biblical truth in these incredibly relevant topics for today.
You know, another element that I've always really appreciated about this conference are the testimonies that are sprinkled throughout the 2 days, Friday evening and all day Saturday. Is that going to be an element this time around? Because I think these are powerful testimonies of what God has done and is doing in the lives of individuals.
Yes, in fact, testimonies are really important. We have them throughout the entire day, all day Friday. It starts at 9 a.m., by the way, Pacific time, and goes through 3 o'clock both days on Friday and Saturday. And yes, we have life stories of people who have grappled with this and overcome and are in the process of overcoming from all across the country, which is really fun. And I'm looking forward to people hearing those testimonies, hearing those stories of God interacting with humans who are grappling with some really intense things.
And you know, this is
what a difference that made. Sorry.
Yeah. This is such a highly charged issue. There are some church leaders who have retreated into the notion that while God can transform the life of any unbeliever and give them a relationship with Christ, this is an area that God simply cannot change, cannot transform an individual who is struggling with their sexuality. And many leaders have simply given in to suggest, well, this is the one exception where God does not have the power or the desire to change. What do you say about the spectrum of beliefs that have now infiltrated the church in terms of embracing LGBTQ issues or embracing them in part or believing that, you know, any number of things? Is that going to be addressed in the theology of these issues?
Right. It will be, and you know, part of the thing is the messaging that's been coming at the world, the culture, for probably, since 1980. since late 1980s. So 30 years of messaging has been coming at everybody in this culture and around the world that gay is good and that gay cannot be changed, and that it's something that's inherent in a person. They're born that way. That born the way theory is really a theory that hasn't been proven scientifically. Some in the church have adopted that view, and from there you come to the conclusion that God can't transform lives in that area, whereas Scripture has no limitation attached to it. Transformation is metamorpho, which is really from the Greek, it means to transform from the inside out, in particular with Romans 12:2, meaning to, to change into another form, to undergo complete change under the power of God to find expression and character and conduct. And it lays stress on the inward change according to a process of becoming like Christ. So Romans 12:2 doesn't add any limitation. In fact, 1 Corinthians 6, 9 through 11, leading up to verse 11, it mentions who will not inherit the kingdom of God. And then it says, but such were some of you. Amongst that list prior were people who were homosexual identified or had sex with men who had sex with men. In fact, that's the language that's in 1 Corinthians 6, 9 through 10. And so when Paul's referencing that and saying, such were some of you, but you were washed, but you were sanctified, but you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of our God, that's verse 11, he's referring to all those folks above, amongst whom right in the smack dab middle is the people that the church now says cannot be transformed, mm-hmm. or some elements. So Scripture hasn't changed, but unfortunately, we have begun to adopt the cultural messages.
We're talking with Ann Polk. She's the executive director of Restored Hope Network. The annual conference, Hope 2.0, is coming up. It's going to be an online conference, the 12th and the 13th. I want to make sure we get those times right. And when we come back from the break, we'll clarify how you can register and what those times are. This year featuring Sean McDowell, Joe Dallas, Linda Seiler, and Ann Polk. And I could sit and hear her talk on the subject just as well as any of the others. But we'll continue our conversation in just a few moments. So stay with us.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
I'm continuing my conversation with Ann Polk. She's the executive director of Restored Hope Network. Their annual conference is coming up, Hope 2.0. This year, it's going to be online. So I'm so grateful that it's able to continue. It's coming up this Friday and Saturday, June the 12th and 13th, featuring Sean McDowell, Joe Dallas, Linda Seiler, and many, many others. You can find out more at restoredhopenetwork.org and look for all the details of the conference. Now, let's talk about the practical things with regard to joining an online conference. How do we do that?
Well, it's pretty exciting, this whole online thing, although I prefer in person, to be very honest. The online event, all you have to do is go to our website, restoredhopenetwork.org, click on the events tab. There's a little tab across the top. Click on that. Register by going to the registration page. Go ahead and fill that out. You can even do it up till the day of the event itself. And then a couple of emails will come back to you with links to join the program on that day. It also will be automatically recorded so you can listen to it later. So anything you missed at whatever time you did join it, we'll have access to play on demand, which is really kind of cool with the same link.
I think I misspoke earlier and said that the conference is Friday night and Saturday. That is not the case. Tell us what the timeline is for both Friday and Saturday.
You bet. It's 9 a.m. Pacific time. And believe it or not, we have to go through all the different time zones of the country with online, which is funny. But 9 a.m. through 3 p.m., and then we take a half-hour break for lunch at Pacific time, 12 to 12:30. So, and you can see the schedule on the Restored Hope I can't even say the name of our website. RestoredHopeNetwork.org website. If you go to the Hope Conference under Events, you'll see schedule, and that will give you kind of the rundown of the speakers, the registration, the schedule, who's speaking when, that kind of thing. And so really good news there that you can check it out.
Why do you think it's important to hold this conference? I think I know the answer to this question, but for people who have yet to attend, a Restored Hope Network conference. Why do you think it's important to hold this annual event?
I think the biggest reason for holding it is hope itself. Hope. Mm-hmm. Hope in Jesus. Hope that life, you're not stuck with what you think you've been dealt. I remember back in the day, and this is a long time ago because I'm not so young now, but when I was in college at UC Santa Barbara, I believed I was born gay because I had feelings that had shown up. And then I went to talk to a counselor on campus. It was a secular but semi-Christian counselor who said, oh, it's no problem. You can embrace the Bible and embrace homosexuality. No big deal. And I just knew in my heart of hearts that that was not right. And so I threw out what I did, little I did know of the gospel, what little I did have of Christian experience. I didn't actually know the God of Scripture. I didn't know, have a personal relationship with Him. And thankfully, less than a year later, I was having dreams about Jesus. I was being plagued by the concept that He really did exist, potentially, and what did that mean to me? And then had an encounter with God in the middle of a Christian group on campus. I just was so aware that this person of incredible authority and incredible kindness was right there in the room that I couldn't see. I knew He was present. I knew God was real, and yet He wasn't in my life. And at that point, everything began to make sense. So when the world is shouting all this stuff about so-called conversion therapy, which is not, by the way, at all a Christian term, it's intended to malign faith, actually. It's intended to demean those who help people align with their faith. It's actually a propaganda term. It's been used for a nefarious intent. Instead of that, God talks about transformed lives, and that's what He did. Right in that instant when I received Him, He brought me from all sorts of darkness, so much more. There was much more than the gay thing. I was aligned with a whole different worldview, and He just plucked me up, forgave my sins, and put me into His kingdom of light. And at that moment in my 19-year-old life, it made all the difference in the world. I was filled with joy unspeakable for the first time in my entire life. And I was aware that God had forgiven me of everything I'd done up to that point. And He was ready to walk with me through life. What an amazing gift. And so Hope Yes. 2.0 is all about hope. It's all about something bigger than our eyes can see. It's evidence of something much beyond what anyone is going to, any one person there. It's about the hope that comes from eternity, that's reaching His hand out for each one of us to come. Come, my daughter. Come, my son. Come into my kingdom. And so it just so happens that this is a point of ultimate challenge. And it's a place that's been made fun of, that a person can't come to Christ, can't fully come to Him. Whereas, no, each one of us has that privilege of responding to God in faith and repentance, and it is majestic. And so we want to keep the door open where it's very much being challenged, even within the church, to close down, perhaps out of fear. Regardless, we know there's great hope and life in this pathway, and so we're going to do everything we can to keep it open.
Amen. RestoredHopeNetwork.org. We'll put the link on the Georgine Rice Show. You can look that up. This year featuring Sean McDowell, Joe Dallas, Linda Seiler, and many others. It's a great conference. Now, the title is Restored Hope Network. Can you explain work and how Portland Fellowship, which is the local iteration of the network, how you all function?
Yeah, you bet. We're a membership-governed network, and so we are actually formed by a bunch of different ministries across the U.S., one of which, the local chapter out of 50, is Portland Fellowship. And we are just thrilled to have them. I've had long-term relationships with members of that leadership team and know they're doing amazing work, so I recommend Portland Fellowship highly. But yeah, they vote and create the relationship to the board of directors, which is governed, so it's all reconnected back with the members. And I happen to be the executive director, also on the board of directors. But yeah, no, it's a powerful coalition of member ministries across the U.S.
Well, I have to say, I am so grateful for your leadership. You know, people don't recognize the tremendous burden of leadership, the prayer time that goes into just preparing to speak on this subject, the challenge that the enemy brings to those who would speak biblically on the subject. And I'm so grateful for your leadership and for Restored Hope Network that represents this coalition of organizations across the country, ministries that are reaching out to those who want their profession of faith to be reflected in their lifestyle. And again, you can learn more about the annual conference Hope 2.0 coming up this Friday and Saturday, featuring Sean McDowell, Joe Dallas, Linda Seiler, and others at restoredhopenetwork.org. And thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to sitting in at least on portions of the conference coming up this Friday and Saturday.
Well, I sure look forward to having you. And thank you so much, Georgine, for having me on. I appreciate you.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
God bless you.
Wow, what a tremendous woman of faith. And I just have such respect for her. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, she has come to stand for righteousness. And she's a woman of great capacity, but also great humility and leadership. She's a woman of prayer. And again, I would encourage you to pray for Ann Paulk and Restored Hope Network. It's one of the few beacons that stands for biblical truth and does it in a way that is absolutely right in terms of their approach and compassion and reaching out and sharing that message. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We've got news and traffic coming up. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the second hour of the Georgine Rice Show. Glad to have you with us. I want to thank James Blind for producing, Clark Hilton for engineering, Dan Rice for the use of his office. We're taking a look at some of the news stories of the day and some of the issues that are dominating the headlines. In the first hour, we talked about Seattle's autonomous zone. And I wanted to pick up with how social justice warriors are taking over newsrooms. And the Daily Signal, Jarrett Stepman, took up the issue of how news outlets have taken up the cause from a distinctive perspective, abandoning, for the most part, journalistic rules that govern objectivity. He writes that in the wake of the protests and riots that erupted following the killing of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer, a revealing transformation has been occurring in the country's media landscape. This is now the message coming from the media. The narrative about how society should look at this incident shall remain in accordance with the most radical woke voices. Deviating opinions will not be tolerated. Words rather are violence. Well, that attitude was on full display in a dust-up at America's leading liberal newspaper. Chaos of the New York Times began after it published an editorial by Senator Tom Cotton, who argued that cities with police force forces overwhelmed by looting and violence have the option under the Federal Insurrection Act to request aid from the military. The article's headline was "Call in the Troops," which had been selected by the New York Times editors. In it, Cotton explained how military force has been used to quell domestic unrest in the past, including those who attempted to obstruct desegregation at Little Rock Central High School in Arkansas in 1957. They were used to enforce desegregation. Well, following the article's publication on the 3rd of June, New York Times reporters and editors protested publicly en masse. Many claim that Cotton's opinions put their colleagues in danger. Alex Thompson wrote, New York Times reporters in a rare open revolt over the opinion side, running Tom Cotton's op-ed, calling to deploy the military to restore order, and so on. Now, this was an op-ed, so there was no question as to whose opinion was being reflected. Well, the same New York Times has also published Russian leader Vladimir Putin, a member of the Taliban, a long symposium glorifying the communist Russian Revolution of 1917, and even an excerpt of Mein Kampf in the 1940s to demonstrate the philosophy of Hitler as the nation entered World War II. Yet, an editorial by a sitting U.S. senator articulating views shared by more than half of registered voters and 37% of black voters, according to a Morning Consult poll, is beyond the pale and a literal threat to fellow Americans. Well, instead of standing by the practice of publishing diverse opinions, the New York Times appended a lengthy editor's note to Cotton's column, saying that the piece fell short of our standards and should not have been published. standards that allowed for Russian leader Vladimir Putin, a member of the Taliban, a long symposium glorifying communist Russian Revolution of 1917. I might add. Well, instead of standing by this practice, this is what they've decided to do. The New York Times appended their lengthy editor's note. However, the note didn't list any serious fact-based inaccuracies and only nitpicked at Cotton's characterizations of the protests. It concluded by saying that the tone of the piece was needlessly harsh. And apparently, we couldn't take a needlessly harsh tone. I challenge anyone reading the piece to check out this week's lineup of the New York Times editorials and columns and not find one that's harsh. A recent Paul Krugman editorial column, for instance, insinuated that President Donald Trump is provoking a race war and that the president is clearly itching for an excuse to use force. Now, was that harsh? It didn't end there, however. The editorial page editor, James Bennett, was effectively forced to step down and resigned from the position. Whatever else can be said of the merits of Cotton's piece or of whatever else it's published generally in the New York Times, it's increasingly clear that the newsrooms of the most prominent liberal publications are being taken over by the most radical voices who demand that they maintain an increasingly rigid ideological line and how they cover and comment on the news of the day. No dissenting or disagreeing opinions. Similar revolts and controversies have occurred in other newsrooms across the country. The top editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, for example, Stan Wachowski, resigned on Saturday after he received a blowback from the paper's staff about an article given the headline Buildings Matter Too. Well, the article was about damage to buildings and how riots are destructive. Well, the Inquirer, they issued an apology and said the headline offensively riffed on Black Lives Matter movement and suggested an equivalence between the loss of buildings and the lives of Black Americans that is unacceptable. Meanwhile, the news website Axios released a memo telling its reporters that they join the protest, they may join the protest taking place around the country, and that the company will bail out employees who get arrested and would also cover medical expenses for those who get injured in the process. The fact is, most America's leading mainstream media outlets have leaned to the left, in some cases the far left, of the average American for a very long time, in fact, for generations. The difference this time around, however, is that in the past, they at least attempted to thread the needle of nudging the country leftward without outright devolving into cheerleading for the Democratic Party or leading with activism at the expense of at least some measure of objectivity. Wesley Lowry, who's a correspondent for 60 in 6, it's a short-form spinoff of CBS's 60 Minutes for the Quibi short-form streaming service, wrote of this turning point in journalism on Twitter, and I quote, "Americans view from nowhere, objectivity-obsessed, both sides journalism is a failed experiment. We need to fundamentally reset the norms of our field. The old way must go. We need to rebuild our industry as one that operates from a place of moral clarity." Again, let me repeat that first line. "American view from nowhere. Objectivity obsessed. Both sides journalism is a failed experiment." In other words, one side is all we need to present. Well, that old dynamic of objectivity is crumbling, and newsrooms are now being turned entirely over to the whims of the most active activist social justice warriors who demand political conformity with a strident push toward the left's current cultural and political aims. It's a process that's already taken place on America's college campuses for several generations. And in fact, those of you who saw the documentary we were encouraging you to see, No Safe Places, will have a better understanding of that. As aggressive left-wing activists push the mostly liberal faculty and staff to be more aggressively left-wing. But campus policies and politics are spilling over into the rest of society. And that was the point of the documentary. It's not just limited to college campuses, but it's having an impact all over the country. Well, Victor Davis Hanson, who's one of my favorite columnists, had this to say about the bitter irony of revolutions and the fact that much of the movement that we're seeing now has little or nothing to do with George Floyd. It has everything to do with being hijacked in some measure by revolutionaries who want to see a fundamental change in the way the republic is run. As these natural and mandate catastrophes continue, we see raw human nature stripped of its pretenses, he writes. The ancient Greeks created new words like paradox and irony to describe the wide gap between what people profess and assume and what they actually do and suffer. Remember the blind prophet Tiresias of ancient drama. In the carnage of Athenian tragedy, he alone usually ends up foreseeing danger better than did those with keen eyesight. After a catastrophic plague and endless war, ancient democratic Athens was stripped of its majestic pretensions, so it was conducting mass executions on majority votes of the people. Throughout history, revolutions often do not end up as their initial architects planned. The idealists who ended the French monarchy in 1789 thought that they could replace it with a constitutional republic. Instead, they sparked a reign of terror, the guillotine, and mass frenzy. Yet the radicals who hijacked the original revolution and began beheading their enemies soon were themselves guillotined. It was not democracy, but rather the dictator Napoleon who put an end to the French domestic unrest. He assumed more powers than had the executed Bourbon King Louis, who had set off the revolution in the first place. The COVID-19 epidemic, the nationwide mass quarantine, and the massive protests, looting, rioting, and arson that have all followed the police killing of George Floyd have resulted in similar paradoxes. Social distancing and mandated lockdowns for months have been the source of endless fighting between people and their government. Red and blue states often adopting diametrically opposite policies. But the massive demonstrations and rioting saw hundreds of thousands of protesters jammed together and often without masks. That mass disobedience to quarantining will tell us, better than any university modeling, whether the virus spikes or is indifferent to thousands of who congregate in the streets. The lockdowns were politically weaponized during this election year. Blue states thought the sinking economy would hurt President Trump's reelection bid. Red states wanted to open up as quickly as possible to get the economy back and running before November. Yet the mass progressive protests and violence forced an unplanned end to mass quarantining and thereby inadvertently helped jumpstart the country back to business. Those who despise Trump may have done the most to help him. Blue states pride themselves for their liberal governors, big city mayors, police chiefs, and state attorneys general. But progressive urban bastions like Los Angeles, New York, Minneapolis, and Philadelphia are also the ground zero sites of arson, violence, and looting where racial relations are the worst. As violence spiked, there were public and private calls to disband the vastly curtail police forces throughout California, Illinois, and New York, but these were the very states where security and safety are the most unsure. If blue city councils do manage to defund and or dismantle their police forces, as a veto-proof majority of councilors have pledged to do in Minneapolis, they will teach Americans whether social problems, crime, and urban decay are made better by the absence of their own police. Our recent protests started out idealistically by calling attention to the racism that had allowed four Minneapolis policemen to kill George Floyd while in police custody. But that tragic killing sadly became overshadowed by protests and violence where cruel irony abounded. White Antifa arsonists occasionally helped torch Black-owned small businesses in the name of Black Lives Matter. Liberal New York Times senior editors were condemned as sellouts and racists for allowing free expression on their editorial pages by their own younger woke staff who claimed to be more ethical. Videos appeared of children screaming in cruel fashion to their own parents as racists. Professionals took a knee to own up to their supposed racist sins in Maoist-like mass confessionals. NPR asked listeners to decolonize their bookshelves. The NFL now confesses it was wrong to have asked players to stand for the national anthem, but those very protests once sank their television ratings, turned off fans, and slashed attendance. Quarterback Drew Brees one day declares that he is disturbed when the American flag is sullied. On the next, he is shamed into apologizing for his patriotism as if he was reprogrammed in a re-education camp. Zero bail policies have released violent protesters hours after they were arrested, often to allow them to repeat the violence that got them arrested in the first place. No matter, oblivious, the revolution only steamrolls ahead. Women shave their heads to curb their whiteness by clipping off their straight hair, as if in some fairy tale their self-confessed white privilege disappears with their bangs. Demands rise that colleges must spend more for racial administrators and programs as they face insolvency, and faculty layoffs. This is the revolution that is being televised. The bitter irony is what Victor Davis Hanson points out. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back in just a few moments.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show on this Thursday afternoon. Well, apparently for some protesters, the irony of their unmitigated ignorance knows no limits. So says Nate Jackson, pointing out that while Black lives, business, and neighborhoods matter, so do some monuments that reflect the history of Black lives. Exactly 123 years to the day that it was dedicated, the Shaw Memorial, it's a monument honoring the first all-volunteer Black regiment of the United Army in the Civil War, was defaced by rioters demanding justice for African Americans. One of the soldiers, Sergeant William Harvey Kearney, carried the American flag throughout the battle, never dropping it despite being shot 7 times. Kearney was the first Black American to receive the Congressional Medal of Honor for action. No matter, it's a monument, it's in the U.S., it must be defaced. Well, I'm referring, of course, to the 54th Massachusetts Regiment of Colonel Robert Gould Shaw. It was memorialized in 1989 by the movie Glory. According to Derek Wilburn, executive director of the Rocky Mountain Black Conservatives, they're out there defacing the memory of the original Black Lives Matter crusaders. They gave their lives blood for Black lives. Perhaps these peaceful protesters should learn some history. Well, vandals in Washington, D.C. weren't any better. The U.S. ambassador to India issued an apology after protesters defaced the memorial of Mahatma Gandhi. Clearly, they don't believe, as Gandhi did, in peaceful protesting. Well, historical ignorance and criminal vandalism is certainly bad, but it only scratches the surface of how riots over Black lives have mostly devastated and taken Black lives. Black-owned businesses have been burned to the ground, costing the life work of entrepreneurs. Black neighborhoods were torched, destroying the homes of poor Blacks. At least 17 people have been killed during rioting, and the vast majority were, you guessed it, Black, whose lives, we're told, matter. In Chicago, the weekend after George Floyd's death was the deadliest in the city, since at least 1961. Murder data doesn't go further back than that, as there were 18 murders in 24 hours and 24 dead throughout the weekend. The victims and perpetrators were predominantly Black. Ironically, the race-baiting and gun-grabbing Reverend Michael Flager, one of Barack Obama's Chicago cronies, said it was open season because, as people told him, there's no place, no police anywhere. Remember that Democrats want to defund police in Democrat-run cities that will become even more dangerous killing fields without any presence of law and order. Robert Woodson, a conservative civil rights leader and founder of the Woodson Center, says the contradictions and the hypocrisy of these so-called social justice warriors, they are more concerned about their own virtue signaling, even if it means the continued destruction of Black Americans, end quote. Well, Black lives do matter. So do Black businesses and neighborhoods and monuments to past achievements and sacrificial service. Someone should clue the rioters, the vandals, the arsonists, and the murderers. And this is one of the things that is so incredibly frustrating to me as an African American, when this issue is wrested away from African Americans and sincere allies who are focusing the attention on what happened to George Floyd, and that we want to see prevented from happening in the future. Attention is diverted from the legitimate cause onto other things at the cost of Black lives and Black livelihoods. Very frustrating. Well, in other news, the debt of the federal government topped $26 trillion for the first time on Tuesday, when it climbed from $25 trillion to $26, according to the data released today by the Treasury Department. The federal debt has topped $24 trillion for the first time on April in 2020. That was the seventh. It then climbed another $1 trillion in just 28 days, topping $26 trillion for the first time on May the 5th. Only 35 days had elapsed from when the debt topped $25 trillion threshold on the 5th of May to yesterday, when it topped $26 trillion for the first time. It is staggering to consider. Well, the 28-day climb from $24 trillion in debt to $25 trillion and the 35-day climb from $25 trillion to $26 trillion are the two fastest periods in which the federal debt has risen from $1 trillion threshold to another. And it is extraordinary. $26 trillion debt, federal debt, for the very first time. Dr. Deborah Birx, who was President Trump's coronavirus response coordinator, warned the nation's governors on a conference call that 70 coronavirus testing sites had been destroyed amid the widespread protests in the wake of the death of George Floyd. During the Monday call, a recording of which was obtained by media, she told governors that they should scramble now to make sure there is testing available in urban areas. In urban areas, these very areas that they're attempting to protect, in quotes. Vice President Mike Pence, the head of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, said that spikes in cases stemming from the unrest are an issue our team is following, and there is concern, although not data thus far. Burke's comments mirror what Dr. Anthony Fauci, who has raised concerns that the protests could lead to a spike in cases. It's a perfect setup for further COVID spread in the sense of creating these blips, which might turn into some surges, he said, speaking at a local radio station. Members of the Washington, D.C. National Guard have already tested positive for coronavirus since being deployed on the 31st of May to help deal with the mass demonstrations and rioting in the nation's capital. Data show that Texas, California, Oregon, North and South Carolina, Mississippi, Utah, Arkansas, and Arizona have all been seen sharp increases. And, I mean, there are other explanations that are possible, the increase in testing and so on. But, again, this is from what Dr. Birx is citing. Anyway, a sharp increase in coronavirus hospitalization since Memorial Day as states have begun to open up following months of lockdown. We've got migrant workers coming into the area and more testing. So there are other issues that may be contributing to that blip. In any case, governors have been warned by Dr. Birx of that very thing. We'll continue to follow that story. Meanwhile, one thing has become crystal clear in recent days. Public health and science are not so much about actual health and science. On the contrary, public health and science are really code words for telling people to shut up and do what supposed experts usually tell us to do. We'll tell you more about that. Harold Hutchinson points out that playing favorites is how science loses credibility, and we're seeing that with the pandemic and the protests. We'll talk more about that when we come back from the break. Also, the number of U.S. coronavirus cases has surpassed 2 million in the United States, the spike in many areas, while Europe's numbers are in decline. We'll tell you more about that when we return. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Well, the U.S. coronavirus cases has surpassed 2 million. The spike in many areas with the Europeans declining, according to the CDC. Well, confirmed cases of the coronavirus passed the 2 million mark here in the U.S. on Wednesday, with the infection rates in many areas appearing to spike despite declines in infections throughout Europe, according to reports. Well, the U.S. has seen 36.5% increase in daily cases in recent days with street protests and states' reversals of shutdown policies. It's a striking difference compared to the top 10 other countries with the most COVID-19 infections to date, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control. Now, in addition to the protests, and we're not yet clear as to whether or not that spike is attributable to those gatherings at all, but we do know that increased testing will naturally bring increased numbers. Worst times are ahead, Joe Gerald, who's a public health researcher at the University of Arizona, said. He's helping to provide projections to the state's health department, according to the Washington Post. The preparedness of evidence indicates communities' transmission is increasing. Britain, Spain, and Iran had roughly a 20% decrease in cases in recent days, according to the report. Meanwhile, Italy and Germany, they saw their numbers decline by more than 38%. Brazil, seen as the new virus epicenter in recent weeks, saw its infections decrease by more than 10%, according to Yahoo News. Well, in the U.S., 9 states, Texas, Arkansas, South Carolina, Nevada, Arizona, North Carolina, Florida, Utah, and Oregon all set new highs on Wednesday based on 7-day rolling case averages, according to the Post. Now, keep in mind, in Oregon, we have migrant workers who have been responsible in part for the spike, who came with the disease arriving in the state. So accounting for why that spike is occurring in Oregon, although in terms of sheer numbers, it's barely a spike compared to other areas. Well, in the U.S., that has been the case. Well, five states, Montana, Arkansas, Utah, Arizona, and Texas, have seen coronavirus hospitalizations rise by at least 35%. Well, the latest figures appear to contradict the president's view of the outbreak last week as somewhat rosier. And again, we don't know the cause for that spike, and it may be a simple explanation as testing. But the president said last Friday, we were able to close our country, save millions of lives. Open, and now the trajectory is great. But again, until we know the reason behind that increase in numbers, it may or may not be that the president's words stand true. Well, Arizona's health director wrote a letter to the state's hospitals telling them to fully activate their emergency plans as numbers climbed last week, the Arizona Republic of Phoenix reported. We have seen a steady climb of COVID-19 cases in Arizona over the last 2 weeks. This trend is concerning us and also correlates with a rise in cases that we were seeing in our hospital ICUs. The number of Arizona COVID-19 patients using ventilators had quadrupled, according to the organization. And while South Carolina has seen its highest numbers in daily cases, the governor there replayed the Palmetto State that they wouldn't impose any new restrictions on the public, but he stressed the importance of taking voluntary measures to stay safe. And that, for the most part, is what states are doing across the country in response to the increase in numbers. Well, the leaked report out of Germany is causing all sorts of problems for its government and media because it portrayed the handling of the coronavirus shutdown as a failure. It's a 93-page report, and analysts of the crisis management, it was written by a team of scientists from several German universities appointed by the interior minister. Well, the scientists take the German government to task on several points. Among them, the danger posed by COVID-19 was overestimated and did not cross a threshold that went beyond normal levels for a new virus. They also criticized the German government, saying that people who died from COVID-19 were statistically more likely to die this year anyway due to poor health and ancillary conditions. They argue that now 400,000 deaths worldwide due to COVID-19 is eclipsed by the 1.5 million deaths caused by influenza in 2017-2018. And the COVID-19-focused German healthcare system has postponed life-saving surgeries and treatments, making the overall health picture in the country worse, not better. Well, the embarrassed German government and its friends in the media there have closed ranks to minimize the damage done by the report. The first move in its damage control strategy was to shoot the messenger, figuratively speaking, of course. Stephen Cohn, who is identified with leaking the report to the press, has been suspended from duty and is currently having his name dragged through the mud by willing members of the media. Isn't it telling how we're seeing more instances of journalists in Western societies gleefully operating in conjunction with the government? Well, the report is out there, tough, and while German politicians remain committed to burying it and moving beyond the issues, citizens have grown irate about the news, taking to the streets to voice their concerns. Now, this is part of a larger international backlash against government's imposition of national quarantines and economic shutdowns to contain the virus. Well, the accusation that the total shutdown was an overreaction or even a government power grab is one of the federal and state government are facing here in the United States as well. Around the country, states have begun shedding draconian virus restrictions, allowing people to move about more freely and businesses to reopen. Responses to the reopening have been predictable on a scientific and political level. What happens from this point forward is going to be an interesting thing to observe. Two separate reports released by the journal Nature and by the Imperial College London put forth the idea that the shutdown prevented an additional 60 million infections in the U.S. and elsewhere. Scientists did find that school closures did not have an appreciable impact on preventing the spread of the virus, but claimed that further study was needed. The timing of these additional reports that essentially praise the quarantine efforts of the federal and state government is a bit suspect, critics say, as much of the data reached in the reports is still in play. There may be a time when we can accurately determine whether the lockdown and the price we paid for it was worth it, but it's too early to tell at this point. Many supporters of it are looking for any vindication in their efforts to close down the country, and many even an excuse to go back to that at some point. Well, the question that will be on many minds and already posed in many places is this: what do we do if there are no significant spikes in COVID-19 cases after opening the states? How should we interpret this information? Were we overly cautious? Was it a government power grab in disguise? Is government capable of handling a major national emergency? Only time will tell. At this point, we erred on the side of caution, and we're hoping an honest evaluation will follow in the wake of a vaccine and in the clear light of a post-COVID-19 pandemic and sheltering in place. It can be evaluated in meaningful and constructive ways. Hey, you're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back to wrap things up.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Welcome back. You're listening to the final segment of The Georgene Rice Show. I wanted to let you know we just got some new numbers from the Oregon Health Authority. Apparently, Oregon is reporting 178 new confirmed and presumptive COVID-19 cases and two new deaths. Again, according to the Oregon Health Authority, they've claimed two more lives here in Oregon, raising the state's death toll to 171, according to the authority from midday today. They report 178 new confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19, bringing the state's total to 5,237. The new cases are in Clackamas County with 47, Clatsop with 1, Crook 2, Deschutes 1, Hood River 1, Jefferson 3, Lake 2, Lane County 3, Lincoln County 9, Marion County 34, Multnomah County still not in phase 1 at 43, Polk County at 4, Umatilla 4, Union 1, Wallowa, Wasco, Washington 15, and Yamhill 6. Well, Oregon's 170th COVID-19 death is an 84-year-old woman in Clackamas who tested positive on the 6th of June, died on the 9th. The location of her death is unknown at the time. She had underlying medical conditions. And Oregon's 171st COVID-19 death was a 66-year-old man in Yamhill who tested positive earlier this month at Willamette Valley Medical Center. He had underlying medical conditions as well, holding true to that combination. The count marked the highest daily total since the onset of the pandemic. Now, the reasons they're saying for the higher numbers are tied to several factors, including widespread availability of testing, that's significant, increased contact tracing, and active monitoring of close contacts of cases. Now, workplace outbreaks are another source of the higher number as well, and we know some specific locations where that has been the case. So these higher case counts serve as a reminder that Oregonians need to continue to maintain physical distancing, wear face coverings where physical distancing cannot be maintained, and follow good hand hygiene. So that remains the same. We need to be vigilant for the sake of our own health and for the sake of others as well. So do make note of that. In other news, the White House is preparing for a decision on DACA. The Supreme Court is expected to rule on that case, and the White House is prepared for a favorable decision, although until one is rendered, we don't actually know. Well, the Trump administration does anticipate a victory in the Supreme Court to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, the nation's number two Homeland Security official said yesterday. We have all the usual judicial challenges. You see judges trying to get in the way of what we are doing all the time. Ken Cuccinelli, who's the acting director, the acting secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, during a webinar sponsored by the Heritage Foundation. He was referring to lower court rulings protecting the 2012 executive actions by the Obama administration to shield from deportation some 700,000 legal immigrants who originally entered the country as minors, I should say illegal. The existing DACA program would be phased out, Cuccinelli said. Any day now, we are prepared to implement that. We fully expect to win this case, which will mean that the president's wind down of DACA can take place. Cuccinelli also talked about state and local sanctuary policies and many other immigration-related issues during that online program. And the Senate Judiciary Committee on Thursday approved subpoenas for documents and testimony from top Obama administration officials as part of the panel's investigation into the origins of the Russia probe during the 2016 presidential election. Now, the committee voted on Thursday to approve a measure giving broad authority to Chairman Lindsey Graham to subpoena more than 50, mostly former Obama administration officials, as part of that investigation. The subpoenas apply to former FBI Director James Comey, former National Security Advisor Susan Rice, and former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, and others. McCabe, Comey. Their day is coming, Graham says. Well, the panel rejected a call by Democrats to subpoena those associated with President Trump or the Trump campaign. The Democrats sought subpoenas for George Papadopoulos, Michael Cohen, Roger Stone, and former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, among others. All amendments and authorizations were approved or tabled on party line votes. The committee last week was slated to vote on whether to give Graham the power to issue those subpoenas, but after hours of debate last week, the panel decided to wait to vote on the matter Thursday amid concerns raised by Democrats on the committee. Well, the subpoena authorization approved today would also cover any documents, communications, and testimony related to any aforementioned matter from current and former officials, including former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, former Attorney General Loretta Lynch, former Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates, former Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power, former FBI officials Lisa Page, Peter Strzok, James Baker, and Bill Prystrap, as well as former DOJ official Bruce Ohr, among others. So the investigation continues, and we'll follow it as it unfolds. Well, there's a lot going on in our world and in our communities. I hope that we are not looking away, but we're taking an opportunity to ask God to examine our hearts. Lord, how would you have me respond to these events? Give me wisdom to sort through what is nonsense, what is rhetoric, what's just, what's right, what's true, what's in the best interest of populations within our community and with our community in general, so that we will not be caught up in the emotion of the season, although these are times that merit a degree of emotion, but that we would be led by a sense of goodness and fairness and rightness and freedom. So I hope all of us are praying for those who are in positions of leadership, even those with whom we've lost confidence or have or disagree with, that God would intervene, and in the same way that he can change the course of a mighty river, that he would change the course of the kings or those who are in authority in our state houses in Washington and elsewhere, so that our nation would once again, and perhaps for the first time, be able to address and resolve these issues in a way that is just, fair, and right, and we wouldn't have to revisit them again. I believe only God can change the hearts of men and women to make that possible. And that certainly is my prayer. I hope it's yours as well. Hey, thanks so much for listening today. Want to thank James Blend for producing. Yeah, that's what he did today, producing today's program. Clark Hilden, Hilton for engineering, Dan Rice for the use of his office. And thank you for making the Georgine Rice Show part of your day. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at GRice Show and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.